Today, I'm going to talk about Baladeva Vidyabhushana's Pramaya Ratnavali and issues related to that text. And I hope I can finish about within like a 45 minutes. I've written like 10 pages, so I think that's gonna be about 40 minutes. So bear with me for next 40 minutes after lunch. I hope it wouldn't be too sleepy. Text and context. Oh, by the way, because English is not my first language, so if I'm speaking too quick or if you don't understand my English, just let me know. Text and context. Baladeva Vidyabhushana's Pramaya Ratnavali and the Issue of Lineage. Introduction. In this presentation, I will argue the following three points. 1. It is not possible to have a proper understanding of a text without understanding its context. Point 2. A theological affiliation must be distinguished from a nominal affiliation. Point 3. The Pramaya Ratnavali clearly belongs to the Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition, not to the Madhvas. I will prove these three theses by the following four steps. Firstly, I will briefly describe the identity and the context of the Pramaya Ratnavali. Secondly, I will summarize the view of some scholars who think that the text under discussion belongs to the Madhvas. Thirdly, I will argue for the necessity of differentiating a nominal affiliation and a theological affiliation in the issue of lineage. Finally, I will point out the textual evidence which show that the text belongs to the Gaudiyas. Okay, so the first step, the identity and the context of the Pramaya Ratnavali. The authorship of the Pramaya Ratnavali is usually attributed to the Baladeva Vidyabhushana, an 18th century Gaudiya Vaishnava Acharya. There is no objection to this authorship as far as I'm aware. The text is usually accepted as a very brief summary of Baladeva's masterpiece, the Govinda Vasha, the only full Gaudiya Vaishnava commentary on the Vedanta Sutras. The author. Details of Baladeva's life are not known. However, within the Gaudiya tradition, it is commonly accepted that he was initially trained as a Madhva Vedantist, then later converted to Gaudiya Vaishnavism. Having been trained by Bhishmada Chakrabarti, the eminent leader of the community in the 18th century Vrindavan, he was sent to Jaipur to deal with religious dispute as the representative of the Gaudiyas. In his later life, Baladeva apparently became the leader among the Gaudiya, succeeding Vishwanath Chakrabarti. The date of the text is unknown. However, it is possible to speculate about the date of the text to some extent. In his doctoral thesis, based on his manuscript research, Adrian Burton suggests that the Govinda Vasha was written sometime between 1743 and 1749. Thus, the upper limit of the text may be set in 1743 if we accept the premise that the Pramaya Ratnavali is a summary of the Govinda Vasha. The lower limit of the text is less certain. There is a commentary on the Pramaya Ratnavali called the Kanti Mala. Krishnadeva Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, a senior contemporary of Baladeva, and Krishnadeva Vedanta Vagisha, a disciple of Baladeva, these two people are two possible candidates for the Kanti Mala. On the one hand, if we accept the former, namely Krishnadeva Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, if he is the author, then the lower limit of the Pramaya Ratnavali becomes 1749, since Bhattacharya died sometime before that year. On the other hand, if we accept the authorship of the latter, namely Vedanta Bhagisha, the disciple of the Baladeva Vidyabhushana, then the lower limit of the Pramaya Ratnavali becomes uncertain because the date of the Vedanta Vagisha is not known. We don't know when he died. The contents. The Premier Ratnavali summarizes the teachings of the Gaudiya Vaishnavism in 9 points. It has been often pointed out that this style clearly imitates the Madhva tradition, since Vyasa Tirtha, an eminent Dvaitin, also summarizes the teachings of Madhva in 9 points. However, this external similarity does not make the Pramaya Ratnavali a Madhva text. Indeed, I will argue that even though the text looks like a Madhva text externally, it is distinctively a Gaudiya text in its actual content. I will also argue that Baladeva intentionally wrote such a text because of the context in which he was in. The context of Pramaya Ratnavali. The Govinda Bhasha and the Pramaya Ratnavali were written in response to socio-religious competitions happening in the 18th century Jaipur. The socio-historical context of these two texts is highly complex and its details are uncertain. However, the following points are crucial in order to understand the text under discussion. So I just briefly summarize what is to be understood in the context of Pramaya Ratnavali. So, point A. Various Vaishnava sects were flourishing in 18th century Jaipur. Point B. These groups were competing with each other for the royal patronage of the King Jai Singh II. Point C. The king demanded that each Vaishnava sect be affiliated with one of the four Vaishnava traditions or sampradayas, namely Shri, Brahma, Rudra, and Sanaka. Point D. The Gaudiyas claimed its affiliation with Brahma sampradaya, namely Madhva sampradaya. Point E. This claim was challenged by other Vaishnava sects on account of apparent theological differences between the two traditions. Point F. The Govinda Bhasha and the Pramaya Ratnavali were written in order to legitimize the Gaudiya affiliation with the Madhva. Since Baladeva employs various Madhva terminologies and concepts in his writings, some scholars believe that Baladeva and his works belong to the Madhva tradition, not to the Gaudiyas. However, I would argue that this is a gross mistake, arising from the lack of proper understanding of the context summarized above, in which Baladeva worked. So, basically, the point is that the Gaudiya Vaishnavas, they were attacked about their authority, and the Gaudiyas needed to establish legitimacy in order to gain royal patronage. And in order to do so, the one strategy is to make connection with the four authorized sampradayas. And then in Gaudiya's case, Baladeva did it with the Madhva sampradaya. Other Vaishnava sects did it with the other groups, like Ramanandis did it with the Ramanuja, meaning Sri Sampradaya. So now I'm just going to summarize these scholars who think Baladeva is a Madhva Vedantist. Baladeva as a Madhva Vedantist. Some scholars, such as B.N.K. Sharma, Sushil Kumar Day, Edward Dimok, and Sutuart Elkman, believe that Baladeva was a Madhva follower primarily due to his employment of important Madhva terminologies and his explicit allegiance to the Madhva tradition in his writings. For example, the eminent scholar of Dvaita Vedanta, B.N.K. Sharma, writes, quote, Baladeva is virtually in agreement with Madhva on all the fundamental points of his system. That is why we find him proclaiming his loyalty to Madhva and affirming the historical and spiritual descent of the Chaitanya Sampradaya from Madhva without any hesitation or mental reservation, not only in the Pramaya Ratnavali, but also in his Siddhanta Ratna, which is an introduction to his Govinda Bhasha. This should suffice to place his allegiance to Madhva Sampradaya beyond question. To end the quote, and there's another quotation. A supposed authority of Gaudiya Vaishnavism, S.K. De, also writes, quote, the theory of Madhva affiliation is to be found in a list of Guru Parampara given at the commencement of Baladeva Vidyabhushana's Govinda Bhasha and in his Prameya Ratnavali. There can be no doubt that the list was made up for the occasion mainly from hearsay or imagination. Baladeva's pro-Madhva tendencies is confirmed by his learned writings. Even if his Govinda Bhasha shows independence, he has entirely given himself up to Madhvism in his Prameya Ratnavali. The finished quote. Based on Baladeva's frequent use of the Madhva terminologies and explicit allegiance to the tradition in the texts, these scholars conclude Baladeva as some sort of a Madhvite with slight deviation. Thus, B.N.K. Sharma writes, Baladeva was a painstaking scholar and an enthusiastic follower of Chaitanya, though not always quite an accurate authority on the philosophy or theology of Madhva. However, Burton's manuscript research quoted earlier tells us that Baladeva became the undisputed leader of the Gaudiya community. According to Burton, the earliest historical data on Baladeva is 1741, when Jai Singh II visited the Vrindavan and met Baladeva there. By this time, Baladeva seems to have already become the authoritative figure in the Gaudiya community. For example, a letter sent to Jai Singh II in 1742 describes Baladeva as being responsible for the Govinda Deva temple, which is one of the main Gaudiya temples in Vrindavan. Around 1751, the Radha Shamasundara temple in Jaipur came to be known as the Vidyabhushana Mandir, indicating that Baladeva was a well-known figure. Also, a document dated in 1755 shows that Madhva Singha, the king of the Jaipur at that time, received Baladeva as the representative Mahanta of the Govinda Deva temple in Vrindavan. All this evidence clearly suggests that in his middle age, Baladeva became the unquestioned authority of the Gaudiya tradition. The following two contextual points must be understood clearly. One, in religiously competitive Jaipur, Baladeva represented the Gaudiyas, not the Madhvas. He was Gaudiya representative. Point two, Baladeva was the undisputed leader among the Gaudiyas. When we become aware of the context Baladeva was in, it is impossible to argue that Baladeva belonged to the Madhvas. In this regard, Richard King, in his Orientalism and Religion, writes the importance of recognizing the interrelatedness of culture and political power. To quote, I wish to argue that both philosophy and the history of ideas should take more seriously not only the social location of the concepts under examination, but also their involvement in a wider cultural field of power relations, or what has become known as politics of knowledge. In particular, I wish to argue for an awareness of mutual imbrication of religion, culture, and power as categories. Power is not mere material conditions without cultural trace, since there is no power in the abstract. Power, indeed, is constituted in particular cultural forms. What is required, therefore, is an approach that avoids materialist reductionism, which denies culture, or culturalist reductionism, which denies power, with a renewed emphasis upon the mutual imbrication of the two. So here, King points, but to finish the quotation, here, the King quotes that the culture and power cannot be independent from each other. Therefore, any cultural or religious text cannot be understood properly without considering its socio-political context. I claim the view which identifies Baladeva as a Madhva is a mistake arising from the lack of attention to the context. Now I go to next step, the three, difference between theological affiliation and nominal affiliation. It has become clear from a contextual examination that Baladeva is a Gaudiya, not a Madhva. However, the fact still remains that in his writings, Baladeva heavily employed Madhva Vedanta, and also he made very clear connection between the two traditions. If Gaudiya and the Madhva are two theologically distinct traditions, and if Baladeva belonged to the Gaudiyas, why did he write as if he were a Madhva? In reply, I will make the following 2 points. Point one, nominal affiliation and theological affiliation must be clearly distinguished. Point two, Baladeva attempted to create nominal affiliation between Gaudiya and Madhva traditions in order to secure the royal patronage of Jaisingh II without sacrificing theological independence of the Gaudiya tradition. Nominal affiliation and theological affiliation are analytical concepts invented for the sake of clarifying the subject under discussion. Nominal affiliation indicates a formal, external, and institutional connection in which the two religious traditions maintain two separate distinct identities in terms of their beliefs and the practices. In contrast, theological affiliation indicates a connection between the two religious traditions based on commonly shared beliefs, ideologies, ethos, agendas, and practices. Differentiating two types of affiliation is necessary due to the phenomena which may be called politics of genealogy. Richard Burkhardt suggests that historically, the various Hindu sects manufactured their genealogies in order to win three limited resources, namely, one, devotees and disciples, number two, pilgrimage routes and pilgrimage centers, and number three, political patronage. So different groups were fighting over these three resources. When a smaller or less established religious group wants to increase its share over these three resources, one of the strategic moves it could employ was to claim nominal affiliation with a bigger or more established group, despite the theological differences between the two groups. Three historical examples may be given in this regard. The first example is Madhva. Initially, Madhva belonged to the Advaitin order, gaining the name Ananda Tirtha. He later propagated his dualism, however, completely rejecting the monistic conclusion of the Advaita Vedanta. But it is widely acknowledged that he nonetheless maintained his Advaita Sannyasa title, Tirtha. It is apparent that Madhva's affiliation to one of the Dashanami orders was formal and non-theological, although the exact reason as to why he maintained the title is not certain, it is quite possible to speculate that the title provided a considerable social prestige, and this was helpful for Madhva to win over the three limited resources mentioned above. The second example is the integration of the Nagas and Advaitins in medieval India. The Nagas were militant or naked ascetics coming from non-Brahminical Shaiva Tantricism. In contrast, the Advaitins were established monks in the Brahminical culture following Shankara's monism. Regardless of their theological differences, the Nagas integrated themselves to the Advaitins in order to gain the social prestige the Advaitins had. This was necessary for them to survive the oppressive Muslim regime. The third example is the Ramanandi's affiliation with the Sri Sampradaya. The Ramanandis claim their descent from Swami Ramananda, who is said to have lived in the 14th century. In the early 15th century, when the sect was still in its forming period, it claimed its affiliation with Ramanuja, Sri Sampradaya, whose authority was already well established. However, in the 18th century, the sect claimed its independence from Ramanuja, since by then its popularity in North India exceeded that of Sri Sampradaya. Again, it is clear that the Ramanandis exploited the practical benefit of nominal affiliation in its formative stage. These three cases show that it is not uncommon to claim nominal affiliation with another more established or authoritative group for the sake of practical gains. My argument is that Baladeva claimed nominal affiliation with the Madhvas out of similar reasons. In 18th century Jaipur, it was mandatory for any Vaishnava sect to be affiliated with one of the four Vaishnava sampradayas. Therefore, it was quite natural that Baladeva claimed the Gaudiya affiliation with the Madhva tradition. However, my hypothesis is that he did so without sacrificing the theological independence of the Gaudiya tradition. So now I go on to the final section, which is the text of Prameya Ratnavali. The fourth, that Prameya Ratnavali, Baladeva's strategy. In the section 2, I have clarified Baladeva's identity as a Gaudiya Vaishnava from the contextual viewpoint. Then, in the previous section, I have made a hypothesis that Baladeva's claim for the Madhva tradition, Madhva affiliation is only nominal and not theological. In this section, I will argue for my hypothesis from the textual point of view. As we have seen, different scholars think Baladeva was a Madhva because he employed important Madhva concepts. However, the mere fact that Baladeva adopted some Madhva concepts does not automatically make him a Madhva, just like the fact that Christian adopted the Greek concept logos to capture the identity of Jesus does not make them Greek philosophers. Indeed, my suggestion is that Baladeva employed Madhva terminologies in such a way that his writings appeared like those of Madhva, but actually they described Gaudiya theology. To demonstrate this point, I will examine Baladeva's usage of two important Madhva concepts in his Prameya Ratnavali, namely the concept of differentiation, Vishesha, and the concept of hierarchy, Taratamya. The concept of differentiation, Vishesha. The concept of differentiation is one of the cornerstones of Madhva Vedanta. However, in the Prameya Ratnavali, Baladeva uses this Madhva concept to justify the identity between Radha and Krishna, which is a doctrine unique to Gaudiya Vaishnavism. In this way, Baladeva substantiates only nominal affiliation between the Gaudiyas and the Madhvas without sacrificing the theological uniqueness of the former. The concept of differentiation is important in Madhva Vedanta since Madhva uses this concept to argue against Shankara's quality-less Brahman, Nirvishesha Brahman. Originally, the concept of differentiation was used by Madhva to explain how one united Brahman can be predicated by plural number of terms, as in Taittiriya Upanishad 2.1, a Brahman is truth, knowledge, and infinite. Shankara interprets these three attributes as synonyms, merely indicating the unity of Brahman. Madhva, however, rejects this view and claims that these three attributes are not synonymous, but they describe the different aspects of Brahman. But then, how can different qualities be attributed to Brahman without distorting the unity of Brahman? Madhva introduces the concept of differentiation to answer this question. Madhva defines Vishesha as the potency in objects which make it possible for one object to have a plural number of predications, even though there is no absolute distinction between an object and its predicates. For example, when we say this cup is yellow, the adjective yellow can predicate the subject, this cup, on account of the concept of vishesha. If the word this cup and the word yellow have entirely same meanings, this sentence has no meaning because it would be entirely tautological. In order for predication to be meaningful, there should be some kind of difference between the subject and the predicate. At the same time, however, there is no real distinction between the quality yellow and the base or the possessor of the quality, the cup. In the Madhva system, this capacity in an object is called vishesha, which makes differentiation between an object and its predicates possible, even though there is no ultimate difference between the two. Now, according to Madhva, this concept of vishesha can be applied in different contexts, and one of them is the relation between energy, shakti, and energy possessor, shaktiman. And this is the context in which Baladeva uses the concept of vishesha in the premier Ratnavali to justify the identity between Radha and Krishna. This doctrine is unique to the Gaudiyas and not shared by the Madhvas. According to Jiva Goswami's Bhagavat Sandarbha, the Bhagavan or the Brahman has three types of energies, namely internal, marginal, and external. Jiva further explains that internal energy has three aspects, namely existence potency, cognizing potency, and pleasure-giving potency. In the Gaudiya tradition, this pleasure-giving potency is identified with Radha, the personification of love of Krishna, prema. In the Pramaya Ratnavali 1.11, Baladeva introduces the concept of vishesha. This is Baladeva's definition of vishesha. Although there is no distinction between the qualities and that which possesses these qualities, the appearance of distinction exists on account of vishesha. Then in 1.2, Pramaya Ratnavali 1.12, Baladeva declares that Vishnu has three energies, and among them, Shri is the highest and non-different from Vishnu. As we have seen above, the concept of vishesha can be applied to the relation between energy and energy possessor. Thus, Baladeva here is saying that although there is no appearance, Baladeva is saying that although there is appearance of distinction between Vishnu and Shri, there is ultimately no distinction between them, as Shri is the highest energy of Vishnu. Then in 1.15, Baladeva replaces Vishnu with Krishna by quoting the Bhagavad Purana 1.3.28, which says that Krishna is the source of all incarnation, including Vishnu. Finally, Baladeva replaces Lakshmi with Radha, quoting Gautamiya Tantra. Thus, by applying the Madhva concept of vishesha, Baladeva first establishes the identity between Vishnu and Lakshmi. Then he establishes the identity of Radha and Krishna by replacing Vishnu with Krishna, Lakshmi with Radha. It should be noted that none of these points are shared by the Madhvas. Therefore, it is clear that even though Baladeva employs the concept of vishesha, he remains theologically faithful to the Gaudiya tradition. The last point, the concept of hierarchy. Baladeva's usage of the concept of hierarchy is another example in which Baladeva establishes Gaudiya theology through the application of Madhva terminology. In the Pramaya Ratnavali, Baladeva employs the concept of hierarchy to describe the rasa theory, distinctively unique to the Gaudiya tradition. According to Deepak Sharma, the concept of hierarchy is central to the Madhva Vedanta. Madhvacharya's theology is thus founded on the importance of Taratamya hierarchy as evidenced in the prevailing systems of Varna and Jati. The centrality of social structure for Madhvacharya and maintenance of the status quo may be a reaction to the diversity and menace of rival Nastika traditions in medieval Karnataka. This Taratamya structure prevails in Madhvacharya's epistemology, ontology, and soteriology, aside from the centrality of Vishnu. may be the key that holds together the entire Madhva philosophy of religion. End the quotation. Accordingly, in the Madhva ontology, all the living beings are put into the cosmological hierarchy as gods, sages, ancestors, protectors, the best among men, those who fit only for darkness, eternally bound, etc. They are classified into three groups, namely highest, middling, the lowest, according to their closeness to Vishnu. Baladeva in the Pramaya Ratnavali 6.1 introduces the concept of hierarchy, saying that there is a hierarchy among the living beings according to their accomplishments. This clearly shows that he employs a distinctively Madhva concept. However, Baladeva does not end up simply introducing a Madhva concept. Rather, he uses the concept to describe the rasa theory, which is unique to the Gaudiya Vaishnavism. According to the Gaudiya tradition, each liberated being has one of the five hierarchical relations with Krishna, namely tranquility, servitude, friendship, parental love, and conjugal love. In this theory, the relation of neutrality is considered as the lowest, and that of conjugal love is considered as the highest. In the Pramaya Ratnavali 6.3, Baladeva describes this aesthetical hierarchy by applying the concept of Taratamya. It is conceived that a hierarchy exists among people who are remembering the Lord according to the five states, beginning from tranquility and ending with amorous enjoyment. In this way, Baladeva transforms the cosmological hierarchy of Madhva Vedanta to the aesthetic hierarchy of Gaudiya Vaishnavism. Therefore, in his adaptation and application of the concepts of hierarchy, it is clear that Baladeva uses the Madhva concept in the service of the Gaudiyas. Conclusion. In the last section, we have seen that Baladeva's Pramaya Ratnavali establishes two of the most significant doctrines within the Gaudiya tradition, namely the identity of Radha and Krishna and the Rasa theory. Neither of these points are shared by the Madhvas. Therefore, the Pramaya Ratnavali must be seen as a Gaudiya text in its contents. If Baladeva produced the Pramaya Ratnavali as a Gaudiya text, why did he employ the Madhva terminology in such a way that it appeared as if it were a Madhva text? When we examine the context of the Pramaya Ratnavali, we can clearly see that it was a strategic move Baladeva employed in order to secure royal patronage for the Gaudiyas in the religiously competitive environment of 18th century Jaipur. On the one hand, he needed to establish nominal affiliation with the Madhva Sampradaya, which was one of the four accepted Vaishnava Sampradayas. On the other hand, he had to protect the theological uniqueness of the Gaudiya Vaishnavism. By adopting Madhva concepts in the service of Gaudiya theology, Baladeva accomplished both ends at once. A careful examination on the text and the context of the Pramaya Ratnavali reveals its identity as a Gaudiya text. Furthermore, it must be also concluded that it was Baladeva's deliberate intention to disguise the text as one belonging to the Madhva Sampradaya by employing the concepts of that tradition. Therefore, those scholars who identify Baladeva as a Madhva without contextual examination have fallen into a trick which Baladeva set up more than 200 years ago. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Kyo. Now we would invite questions. So if you have questions, please shoot Kyo with them.
Not too.
One clarification needed from you. You said Madhvacharya has borrowed the Advaita terminology.
No.
You said the suffix Tirtha and the Tirtha that is borrowed from the Advaita?
I just mentioned that the title Tirtha is obviously Dashanami title, one of the Dashanami title. I mean, he, Madhva, initially belonged to Advaita order, but late then took sannyasi, but then later he left, but still kept that title, Tirtha, which
but
is...
none of the unknown Advaitins have the suffix Tirtha. Shankara didn't have it, his guru, Govinda Bhagavad Pada, his guru Gaudapada. They didn't call themselves Tirthas.
Yeah, I mean, of course, the history of the formation of Dashanami is quite, how do you say, controversial. I was just reading this PhD thesis done in SOAS, and the author basically is claiming that the Dashanami orders, Advaita orders, these 10 orders of Advaitins, they are actually formed quite late. It's not basically formed by Shankara. But just my point is that the Tirtha is one of the Dashanami order, and then Dashanami order is usually affiliated with the, it's considered as Advaita order, so that's my point.
The Madhvas don't allow you to say that.
Okay.
Because they are just,
yeah,
no question of any kind of affiliation, even in nomenclature.
So where do they say he got the name Tirtha?
That he has to form the Lord, I say. You have to throw more light on this.
Okay.
Yeah. The word Tirtha Naval means any sacred person, any religious teacher for the highest order.
Mm.
Like, you know, they have got Saraswati, the title, Madhusudan Saraswati, in Advaita tradition, like that, you know.
Okay, so...
the title indicating the highest position.
Okay.
Among the ascetics.
Uh-huh. Okay, so the Tirtha, according to...
at the same time, it is not same as the Tirthankara position. The Jains call them Tirthankaras.
Mm.
So that is totally different.
Okay. So according to Madhva tradition, this Tirtha is not the Advaita title. Okay. Oh, I see. That's a good point. Thank you.
That will become highly controversial.
Yeah.
If you develop a thesis like that, and this concept itself will be challenged by the Madhva writers.
Okay. That's a good point. Thank you. I will
take any care. Other questions?
I will take care of it.
Thank you. Just before this, I mean, I was looking through some of the books here, and I just happened to look up this Bhashya on the Sri the Brahma Sutras by Baladeva. And at the end it says that the approach is theistic and based on the teachings of both Madhava and Chaitanya.
Mm-hmm.
So here it's a very parallel sort of approach rather than the disguise that you were talking about. Is this just a misconstruction by the translator here?
What do you mean by parallel?
That it's based on the teachings of Madhava and equally Chaitanya, rather than just Chaitanya.
Oh, because the mention of Madhva is there. Yeah, that's exactly. I didn't.
Is he falling into the same trap?
No. Well, actually, the point is, Baladeva does accept nominal affiliation with Madhvas.
But not on a theological level.
No, that's my argument.
Okay.
That's my argument. But without discussion, the nominal, at least what I call nominal affiliation, is there. It's not my opinion, but nominal affiliation with Madhva is there in Baladeva's work.
Only using concepts, terminology.
Okay, let me try to clarify.
Because you repeatedly mentioned that theologically he was independent.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole strategic move of acquiring that, to acquire the royal patronage or the regal patronage, he used these devices.
Mm-hmm.
Which is perfectly acceptable and quite convincing.
Mm-hmm.
But when we look at through the books, and this is the Vedanta Sutras, one of the first three.
Yeah.
And it's the fundamental commentaries.
Yeah, exactly.
In which the whole theistic principles are established.
Yeah.
And so when it says based on Madhva and Chaitanya.
Yeah, the Madhva is mentioned there.
Yeah, first.
Yeah, exactly. So this text must belong to Madhva.
As well.
That's how you think, right? That's exactly what Baladeva wanted you to think.
So this person has fallen into the same trap?
No, he's just translating Baladeva's text. Baladeva does write that the Chaitanya comes from Madhva Sampradaya. He does say that. He does say that.
Does he explicitly ever say in any of his texts that, even later, that this was one of his sort of moves, strategic moves to win that?
Yeah, that's
obviously that would prove your thesis.
Yeah, but I think that's kept secret.
To read his diary.
That must be kept secret. And then the Gaudiyas, even today, they do claim Madhva affiliation.
Yes, well, I was going to come to that, because this seems, and all the other books that we've sort of acquainted ourselves with that.
Yeah. There's a Guru Parampara list, and then I think starting with Krishna, and then after that, I don't remember exactly, but, you know, yeah, this person, that person, and then Madhva, and then this person, that person, and then Chaitanya, and this person, that person. So, the Baladeva accepts that parampara list, which connects Chaitanya to Madhva, to ultimately back to Krishna. So Madhva is there, definitely. But just my point is that that's just nominal affiliation, but which the Gaudiyas still do claim.
But theologically, they're independent.
Theologically, it's quite different. This, for example, this Radha Krishna. I mean, according to Madhva, Lakshmi is one of the jivas, even though it's I think highest probably of the jiva, but still it's jiva. But according to Gaudiya tradition, Sri is the energy, internal energy of Krishna, so that's quite different, so these two traditions are theologically speaking independent, although there might be some overlapping, you know.
What's the time gap between Madhva and Baladeva?
Baladeva is beginning of 18th century, so Madhva is 1300.
1238.
About 500 years gap.
So,
yeah.
What if somebody came and said there's a sort of evolution of theological ideas?
You mean the Madhva?
Sort of development of theology.
Oh, okay, so you're saying that maybe someone might claim that Gaudiya Vaishnavism is an evolution of Madhva.
Very fine form of
Madhva. Yeah. Of course, you can say that, but I think that's quite unacceptable, because two traditions are quite different. For example, one big difference is between these two traditions is the understanding of Brahman as the material cause. According to Madhva tradition, Brahman is only efficient cause, but not the material cause. But according to Gaudiya tradition, it is Brahman is both, and then the Madhva is quite clear about the point that this world and then living beings are not part of Ishvara. That's very clear in Madhva Vedanta, and because he really wants to maintain the purity of Brahman. Or Vishnu, so he's very, very clear about that. So I don't think, well, of course anyone can say anything, but if you say that the Gaudiya Vaishnavism is evolution of the Madhvas, probably you wouldn't be accepted, at least by Madhvas.
Also, possibly if the Gaudiya is more of a it's a unison of the Madhva and the Advaita with the philosophy like Chintya Bhina Bheda. Because Madhva didn't accept that philosophy. And Chaitanya put that philosophy in. So there could be another difference between the Madhva and
Yeah. It's these two are quite different, and yeah, I mean, according to Madhvas, they don't accept the Gaudiyas or the part of Madhva. They don't accept that Gaudiya is a part of
I think I'd just like some more clarification, and perhaps Professor can also help some clarification about what exactly is a sampradaya. Is it, one notion is that it's a very static thing, that there's the same doctrine or the same theological view, the same siddhanta is presented, you know, from whoever the beginning of the sampradaya is, whether it's Sri or Brahma or whoever. And that doctrine is passed down in a very static, unchanging form from the very beginning of time to right now. Another view of a sampradaya could be that it's much more fluid, that it takes certain elements and develops them.
Mm-hmm.
And taking the Bhagavata Purana, for instance, it claims to be a development of the Vedas. It's the essence thing. The Brahma Samhita, it's developing out of something that was there prior. So it seems like what you're saying is that this notion of a sampradaya is not a static thing where the same siddhanta is passed down, but actually it gets developed from between Madhva and Baladeva by Chaitanya. Although it is based on Madhva, it is a development of Madhva. The link is saying, you know, well, it's not Madhva, but it is based on Madhva enough. It's inspired by Madhva, so to speak, but not Madhva.
Yeah.
Is that the notion of a sampradaya? Is that the traditional?
Of course, as you know, each school has some tradition. Ramanuja's tradition.
Mm-hmm.
Madhva's tradition, Shankara's tradition, and they were their own way of following. And you can trace the influence of one or the other also, in the course of time. For example, the influence of Ramanuja can be felt in other systems as well. For example, Swami Narayan Sampradaya, he calls himself directly, this is Navi Vishishta Beta. I accept Ramanuja Sri Rashi as the Pramana, Gita Rashi as the Pramana. But still it is a different tradition, right? So that kind of influences, interchanges are quite possible in the long history of our development of religious things. You should not be static, is what I mean. This is my traditional, you must be actually confined to that only. But now it's a developing society, and then ideas are changing, and so many new systems are, you know, raising their heads. Try to accommodate everything, and a huge Hinduism is not actually a product, it's a process. Hinduism is a process. And we have to accept it as a huge umbrella. And then so many systems are coming up. And each tradition has its own individual. At the same time, the influence of other systems or that, or other traditions cannot be denied. It's my approach. And the dark spots in the meaningless tradition, in the words of Dr. Varahakrishnan, see, Hinduism, Hindu religion can be re-embraced, can be made fresh and more acceptable, provided the dark spots of meaningless traditions are removed or dispelled by the light of living faith. So living faith, so if you stick to that, is it acceptable? Acceptable, otherwise throw it out. There are certain things which are really meaningless in traditions, as I myself see. For example, in the Vaishnava tradition, there are two main branches called the Vadagari and the Thangari. The southern sect as well as the northern sect, which owe their allegiance to two great acharyas who are more or less contemporaries. One is Pelle Lokacharya and the other is the younger one, Vedanta Deshika. Now, these traditions have become two independent units now. And if I belong to Thangari, who are Thangari? Why? Even the names, you know, the nams they have on the forehead, one looks like Y, another looks like you, the parabola. And you say, you Y. Then any friendly attitude about these people, they always fight, go to the courts of law to settle some minor disputes into law. It is ridiculous. So what is the meaning of these traditions? Of course, each was great in his own way. And what Pelle Lokacharya said is right from one angle, and what Deshika said was right from his own angle. There is no need for open controversies like that. these can be dismissed. Some are lived by people who are now alive to the present situation in which we are. So I think the traditions are great. We are not disputing anybody. But still there must be acceptable, you know, the influence of other traditions on this. So whatever is glorious and welcome. No, the Rigveda mantra is there. Ah, no, Bhadra, Kratavaha, Yantu, Vishwatara. Let no thoughts come to us from all sides. We are open to all influences. So let us not fight in the name of religion or tradition. So it's quite possible that you have rightly said, he follows mantra. At the same time, he is alive, demands of the Gaudiya traditions. And hence he tries to build a bridge, as it were, between these two. In his commentary, Govinda Bhashya, which I had a chance of now reading it to this morning. Very nice written. So that is what is happening about. Any comments?
Just going back to your question, Jonathan. I'm just trying to think about science. It develops. The ideas of the evolution or the theory of everything developed from Newton to Einstein or whatever. Are we looking on a similar process for theology as well? Because on one hand, we're thinking of Sanatan Satya. And Satya is defined as Trikalabhatit. It's beyond time. Eternal truth. So each tradition claims, rightfully in their own way, to be heirs or followers of that eternal truth. And so is there scope for development? If it's claimed to be divinely revealed, for example, the Vedas. How can they be developed? The truth is the truth. It's Trikal about it. Before, now, future. So the question is, if it does develop, and here I am, then I know for sure, by default, then, that I am not at the ultimate truth because there's a future, and maybe 100, 200, 500, 600 years later, there'll be another refinement. And I won't be at that ultimate level of truth because the people, I just happen to be unfortunately born earlier than my predecessor. More successor, sorry. Do you understand my question?
Yeah.
So, I'm just throwing a question back and forth.
I don't think that they're necessarily irreconcilable, the notion of eternal truth, and it's still a process of development. You get, there's the metaphor, I think it's in the Bhagavata Purana, about a river going in and out. Sometimes rivers go underground for some time, and then they come above ground. So the river is like this eternal truth, this eternal body of knowledge, but sometimes it's close to the surface of the ground, and sometimes it's very deep.
Truth, I think, is a multifaceted diamond. Has anybody seen all these facets in one lifetime? Truth is always there. But our approaches differ. Then I think this is true from my own point. Another says, like, what the Veda says, one, truth is one, but wise men call it by different names. And I can't question your claim to knowing the truth, because I know from my own angle. So truth is a grand concept, which only the tips of which are the rays that are disseminated by that, we're able to catch and say, yes, well, I know the truth. But nobody has known the complete truth any time.
I just add my comment, compliment your observation, that as Maharaj said, you know, truth is beyond time. It cannot be changed. But I guess, as Professor Narasimhacharya said, it's our understanding, it's our comprehension of the truth, which goes through evolution over time. So the truth is truth, and it can never change. But then our perspectives on it keep on changing and develops over time.
To what extent we are right, we are wrong. To what extent we have succeeded in knowing the truth. As Swami Vivekananda has said, man does not travel from error to truth, but from one lower truth to a higher truth. There's a gradation. The ultimate we don't know, then we can reach it. Then we are realized the source. The great sages of yore could not reach the stage. Yato vacho nivartante aprapya manasasa. The words bounce back and able to use it. The mind cannot contemplate on the truth. That is the nature of the reality. Which we call God, or whatever name we give, Satyam Jnana Anantam Brahma, Bhagavan, Paramatma, and so on. So we are trying to reach the ladder is there.
Maybe even the truth itself has the capacity to experience differently. The common example is in the Bhagavata when Krishna goes in to kill the Atura, that the different people who are watching Krishna kill Kamsa, they see him in different ways. The sages see him as Parabrahma, his coward boy, see him as their best friend, and the ladies of Vrindavan see him as the highest expression of amorous love, and so maybe a truth itself can be experienced truthfully, but still differently.
Also the Gita says how the truth is revealed at different times in different ways. Paritranaya sadhanam vinashaya shudhiskritam. So again and again, age after age, the Lord appears and reveals truth.
With that, I hate to stop this interesting discussion, but then with that we have to stop today's program right now because we're running out of time and Q has been poking me. I thank you very much for actively participating and coming for this seminar, and I thank Kyo for making such a brilliant presentation. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.